It's trivia time. Do you know which museum was the first one to open in Colombia?
The African Art Museum of Maryland started in Colombia in 1980. Hmm. We were the first museum in Colombia.
And what would you say if I told you there is a financial program designed specifically for kids? Don't believe me? Take a listen.
We make it real for the kids, as young as kindergarten as well, so that they have an idea of this is what it's like to be a grown-up. This is what it's like to give back. This is what it's like to go to work. This is what it's like having financial responsibility, but we break it down so it's age-appropriate.
These stories coming up in February's episode of HOCA Journal, starting right now. Hi, and welcome to HOCA Journal, the show where we highlight the unique and interesting people, businesses, nonprofit organizations, and events happening right here in Howard County. I am your host, Cris Oviedo. Financial literacy is something that is assumed to be an adult matter only. But today in studio, I have someone who works together in an institution that is trying to change that idea and is teaching kids of all ages how to be financially savvy since early on life to impact their future. So, without further ado, here in studio, I have Hannah Nassim, and she is the regional director in Anne Arundel, Frederick, and Howard County of Junior Achievement of Central Maryland. How are you doing today?
I'm great, Cris. Great to be here.
And, you know, let's just dive right into this. I found the website with information about your institution, and on there it says, and I quote, that Junior Achievement is the largest organization dedicated to giving young people the knowledge and skills they need to own their economic success, plan for their future, and make smart academic and economic choices. Can you help us break this down a little bit and tell us how is it that you guys are helping kids look at finances without getting bored so early on in life? Sure. And you know, in a way that it's going to stay with them for the rest of their lives.
So we are a unique organization, and I'm glad you read that because that packs in a lot of information as to what we do. But breaking it down, we are an international organization, so that gives you an idea of the scope and scale. Nationally, we are headquartered in Colorado, but we have over 100 local offices. I am part of the Central Maryland office, which serves Baltimore City and the surrounding counties, Howard, Anne Arundel, and Frederick being my specific corridor that I support. But what makes us unique is, yes, we are working with the K-12 spectrum in the education world, in financial literacy, workforce development, and entrepreneurship skills. What we do that is unique is that we bridge the schools and the businesses together. So how do we make it fun? We make it fun because it's very hands-on, it's experiential, and we bring in the business community to make the curriculum come alive, whether it's in the classroom, in an after-school program, or in the business itself. So we make it real for the kids, as young as kindergarten as well, so that they have an idea of this is what it's like to be a grown-up. This is what it's like to give back. This is what it's like to go to work. This is what it's like having financial responsibility, but we break it down so it's age-appropriate.
You know, and it's funny that you say that, because there's a little fun story that my mom always reminds me of. And it's when I was little, apparently I was asking for something. I wanted something really, really bad. And my mom was like, I'm sorry, I don't have money right now to purchase it. And I was like, but mom, you have a checkbook. Just write it down, sign it, and give it to the person. And mm-hmm. She was like, that's not how that works. Nope. So there is a disconnect. And even when you talk to college students, one of the biggest, I think, complaints that they have is that they really don't have classes that teach them life skills, you know, through high school or through school. So how are you guys coming in and kind of like closing that gap?
So it's very interesting that you say that, because that's what we hear as well. And I think school systems started hearing that as well. And they have integrated those life skills into the curriculum. That's slowly becoming the trend. Slowly is a relative term. It's becoming a need that's recognized and being addressed. So yes, a lot of school systems have, for maybe seniors, you're about to go into a workplace or into college, let's equip you with some of these life skills that you need. We believe that it's never too late, but we can even start earlier. So we have forged partnerships with school systems where financial literacy is recognized and is being implemented in the school system. So we have systematic partnerships, Howard County being one of them, where eighth graders certainly get a unit on financial literacy, and it's our curriculum that's being integrated in the high schools, in the business department, the computer tech ed department. That's where our career success and personal finance curriculum is being integrated into the curriculum. So we're trying to reach out to the students. And the school systems are certainly understanding that it's important to do that as well, and bringing this curriculum to them as early as possible and helping them make connections with the business world so it's not boring and it's more impactful. This is why I learned it. This is why I need to learn this. They understand that. We don't have to convince them that you need to learn this because it's already intrinsic in the curriculum. And they see the impact for it.
You guys also on your website say that you are inspiring the next generation to transform I can't into I can. So what exactly are we talking about when we look at this phrase?
So we'd like to empower students to believe that they can do what they set their minds to, and giving them the skills and the tools and the resources to accomplish that. It's very easy to say, I'm going to become this, whatever it may be, but how do you get there? You know, that's the tough part. It's very easy to aspire to be something. It's very easy to dream and have those dreams, and those are certainly encouraged by parents, community, schools, but who's equipping them with those tools to do so? And that's where we come in. So we have partnerships with our corporate sponsors, our businesses that believe in what we do, and they help. They help with their resources. They help with their experience. They help with their sponsorship. We have our curriculum that pretty much shows students, here are your resources. Here are the choices that you need to make. We're equipping students with how to make those choices, how to get answers for questions that they may have that will help them make those choices. So it's ongoing, it's supportive, and it's engaging that business community to help these kids make these choices. It's decision making. Everything that we're talking about, whether it's personal finances, whether it's career choices, college choices, it's all about decision making. So let's empower these kids to make decisions so that they can be aware of the opportunities that they have in front of them, that they can recognize opportunities. Oftentimes kids don't even realize that was an opportunity. So just that awareness, that empowerment gives kids that sense and the reality that they can control their future.
And so why do you guys feel that it's so important? Because I know we kind of touched on this a little bit already, saying that it's not that it's too late, but it's better almost to start so early. Why is that? What are you guys finding that, you know, with the kids that you're starting earlier, especially like in kindergarten?
We think it's really important to start early because it is fundamentally decision making. So the sooner we have kids equipped with those skills to make decisions, whether, you know, for kindergarten, we in our curriculum, we have the simple age-appropriate decisions, but one of our programs has a decision-making piece where there's one big present and four little presents. Which one do you want? Which one would you choose and why? So it's exploring why they make the decisions that they do, what the consequences of decision-making is. I mean, you may make a decision. These may be the consequences. You own those consequences because you owned your decision. So it's very skill-based, it's very empowering, it's confidence-building, all of those things. The younger we start, the more secure in their future kids will be.
Now, you said you have about 20 programs that you guys offer. Can we, I don't know that we have enough time to look through all of them, but can we talk about at least some of them that you would like to highlight today?
Sure. So unique to Howard County, we have a phenomenal after-school program called JA Rising Women, Junior Achievement Rising Women. And this is an after-school program that's offered to 9th to 12th grade high school girls, girls specifically, because we found that, yes, our curriculum is offered in the schools, that our young ladies weren't gravitating towards this entrepreneurial arena.
Interesting.
Yes. And the Women's Giving Circle was very generous in sponsoring this program. We meet after school. This is fresh in my mind because we are actually closing our fall session. These young ladies have met over the last 13 to 14 weeks and they've launched their own business. So these are girls who don't normally see each other. They're from all over the county, different high schools. They've come together every Wednesday and they have come up with a business plan. They've come up with a product that they want to sell. They've figured out marketing strategies. They've figured out their finances. They've figured out we need stock to be sold. They have shareholders. They've gone through the whole cycle of a business.
Wow.
And these young ladies, what they produced or what their good is a cookbook that highlights in because Columbia's turning 50, to celebrate the diversity of Howard County. So it's a collection of recipes from families in Howard County, so very ethnically diverse recipes. They sold these books and netted over $2,000.
Wow.
So they learned how to do this. It was hard. There were obstacles. And I treated them like employees of a company, and they were expected to behave like employees of a company. So they understood why it's important to be on time, why it's important to meet your deadlines, why it's important to communicate, why when you have an obstacle, how do we talk to our leadership team about solving these problems? So not only are they getting that business experience, but they're getting a very true glimpse of what it's like to work. And what makes this program unique, aside from the body of it, is that we have mentors that help them through this. Because some of the girls, they're ninth graders, they've never taken a business class, they have no idea that it's exposure again.
Right.
But they're guided by these mentors that help them. The mentors don't make decisions for them, they advise them. The young ladies make decisions for themselves. So whatever, again, the consequences of their decisions, they own them because they own their decisions.
So what other programs? I know this one. So this one's unique to Howard County?
This is unique to Howard County.
Okay.
Yes.
Are there any other unique programs in Howard County, or are there any other programs just, you know, that are not necessarily unique to Howard County that we can talk about?
Another one that we are... that we feature in our Central Maryland office only because we have the facility. We have converted the back of our office is there's warehouse space, 10,000 square feet of warehouse, and we've converted it into a town. We call it JA BizTown. And our corporate sponsors have actually set up shop there. So they've outfitted spaces to look like their business. So we have a Northrop Grumman that's with the Northrop Grumman logo and the storefront sign, and inside it's an engineering facility. We have a Bank of America. We have a Toyota. We have several of our corporate sponsors who have outfitted this area so that students can come in and actually work the day at JA BizTown. And how do they prepare for that? In the classrooms, their teachers help them with our curriculum prepare for that day. So the kids actually apply for a job at BizTown, whether it's a CEO, a CFO, resource manager, account manager, DJ at the radio, a TV soundboard operator. We have a distribution center. So there's a job for everybody. And everybody applies for a job. They get their job. They prepare for their job. Their culminating experience is coming into our facility in Owings Mills and running the town. They elect a mayor. So there's the mayor who holds town hall meetings, and these students get to experience the local economy, why do businesses depend on each other? Why do we need these businesses there? The kids earn a salary. They learn how to deposit their paycheck into the bank. They learn about saving. They learn that spending's important to the economy too. So they go out and shop for these services, whether they're leasing a car for their business, whether they're buying health insurance for themselves. They learn what a grown-up spends on and why it's important and how that runs the local economy.
Now, is this through school then? Because if I heard you right, you said that this is the teachers or mentors are working with the kids, preparing them for that.
It's a fabulous experience. So currently we have a systemic partnership with Baltimore City Schools. So all fifth graders in Baltimore City go through JA Biztown. So we have one Biztown running every single school day, virtually every single school day. So there's a lot of energy. There's a lot of hustle and bustle at our offices on a daily basis because we have kids circulating through. We have our corporate sponsors coming and helping them. Again, that volunteer piece is so important, where our sponsors come in and help these kids and guide them through their decision making. So we have that partnership with Baltimore City. We have one pending with Baltimore County. So yes, it's a complete buy-in from the school system. They understand, they recognize the importance of what we are doing and what an amazing experience it is for the students to go through that. And certainly a memorable day for staff, school staff, teachers, the students, and our corporate volunteers.
Absolutely. So talking about volunteers, and I know that those are two programs out of the 20. So why don't we tell listeners the website where they can go and find out about all these other 18 programs that we didn't even get a chance to talk about.
So what's great about what we offer is that we have something for anybody who wants to volunteer and work with kids and have an impact on students exploring their possibilities. So we certainly work with our corporate partners on community engagement. But if anybody wants to volunteer with us, they would have a conversation with one of our directors. If it's Anne Arundel, Frederick, or Howard, they would speak with me about what their schedule's like, what their availability's like, what their background may be like, if they're comfortable talking with younger kids, older kids, after school, during school. We have something that will certainly match anybody's goals, needs for volunteering.
And then the website where they can get in touch with you guys is?
JAMaryland.org.
And it's, so some of the programs, we've talked about the programs, are all the programs free? Are some free and some have a fee in order for kids to register and participate?
So most our programs are either through the school system, so it's integrated into the school, so mm-hmm. it's free. Our after-school programs, I can only name a few that students would have to pay for. That would be our summer camp that's coming up in June after the schools close down. That would be something just like any ordinary camp, and that would be in that Biztown facility, so the kids run that the city for the duration of the camp. But usually it's through the school system, and we work with the school systems and our corporate sponsors to get sponsorship for those programs, because we want this to be available for everybody. It's necessary for all of our students.
Exactly. And you know, I personally appreciate that JA recognizes how important it is to educate our young people and make them life savvy almost, you know.
Absolutely.
Is the website the best way to get in touch with you guys, or is there other platforms?
The website's the best way because we do Central Maryland. So depending on where you are, where you live, we have something for everybody in that Central Maryland region. So it's a great place for you to explore and see a little bit more of what we do. And our contact information is there for specific requests that you may have.
JAMaryland.org. Is there anything else that you'd like to talk about before we wrap our conversation up today?
Oh, there's so much. I could go on forever talking about this. I'm passionate about what we're doing. And our volunteers, our corporate volunteers, are very passionate about doing what they're doing with us as well. It's very easy to see the impact of what our programs do for our students. So it's once you're a volunteer, it seems like what else can I do for you? How else can I reach these kids? Are there any other programs? So we would love to have volunteers come and support JA programs and in turn support our students so that they're better prepared for their future.
And that's what I was going to say, in terms support the future of this country, because that's, you know, if you think about it, that's who's going to shape where we're going, regardless of whether it's a Democratic or a Republican government that we have. What we're doing on our day-to-day lives is really what's making that impact, and it's determining where our country's going next. So definitely check out Junior Achievement of Central Maryland. Sounds like a fantastic, phenomenal organization, especially to try to set the kids up with the tools that they're going to need to be financially savvy and really, like I said before, life savvy, because decision making, don't we face that all? Breakfast can be a tough decision sometimes.
You know it.
Hannah, thank you so much. I really appreciate you coming into our studio today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And for HOCA Journal, I'm Cris Oviedo, and we'll be right back.
Major key alert. Don't ever play yourself. Life is like school. You will be tested. So pass it.
Learn the real major keys to getting to college at GetSchooled.com.
Stay focused. Now that's a major key alert.
Brought to you by Get Schooled and the Ad Council.
We are live outside the home of Joe and Rosie Goddard, where a pretty big tickle fight broke out just minutes ago. Sources say their father instigated the laughter. Let's go inside for a comment. Apparently, they have no comment. Dads, let this be a reminder that it only takes a moment to make a moment. Call 877-4DAD-411 or visit fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
When it comes to parenting, there are no perfect answers. But that's okay, because you don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Teens in foster care will love you just the same.
For more information on adoption, visit AdoptUSKids.org. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUSKids, and the Ad Council.
For HOCO Journal, I'm Alex Baker. The African Art Museum of Maryland is dedicated to the encouragement of broader understanding and awareness of the diverse cultures and artistic expressions of the people of the African continent. With me here today to talk about the African Art Museum of Maryland is their director, Doris Ligon. Mrs. Ligon, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be here.
Good to have you. So first question, we'll just kind of start off with this. Just for people who may not be aware of what this is, give us a brief description of the African Art Museum of Maryland.
Thank you very much for this opportunity. The African Art Museum of Maryland started in Columbia in 1980. Hmm. We were the first museum in Columbia. We are exclusively representing the traditional arts of Africa, not exclusively the traditional arts of Africa, but exclusively African art. We don't focus in on African-American art, European-American art, Asian-American. We're all about Africa, and we are an educational institution. The museum was started for that very reason, so that people could better understand the art of Africa. And if you understand better the art of Africa, you understand the people. And if you understand the people, that is a good basis for friendship and better relations. And so then, as my grandmother used to say, you put another wrinkle on your brain. You understand the art, and you therefore understand the people, and you've made friends across the Atlantic.
So I know I didn't write this down, but tell us a little bit about some of the rich history of African art.
African art was deemed or was coined as primitive at one time. And, you know, primitive can mean more than one thing. It can mean early in time. But in this case, primitive meant, not by all, but by some, unschooled or lacking sophistication. And that title or that coined word stayed with it for a long time. And that is one of the things that we would like to eradicate. Now, we don't go into a school and start talking about what used to be or what is negative to think about, because maybe some young people have never heard it that way. We go into the schools, or the schools come to us, or wherever we're invited, and we talk about the positive things. And then if things are asked of us, then we tell them what it is. But we don't go in starting off with, don't believe this primitive or that kind of thing. We go in with the positive things, and yet we will answer any question unless I don't know the answer, and I don't know everything as much as I'd like to think that, you know, that some of us know everything. I know that I don't, but I do know that if I'm asked a question, and after my 40-some years of study of the arts of Africa, I don't know, I will find out the answer. And that will mean that I, too, have learned something. And sometimes the young people and sometimes the older people, too, do throw me for a loop, and I have to go off and investigate or further clarify. And that is called learning. I mean, you never stop learning. And I've learned a lot from the young people, and hopefully they have learned some experiences by coming to or having a representative from the African Art Museum of Maryland come to them. But African art is the traditional arts of Africa send a message, and there's nothing else that you can call it. Traditional African art was designed to be used. It was designed to send a message, and therefore it has a language. Now, in order to understand what it means, you have to speak that language. I don't speak Russian or any other foreign language, foreign to this nation. But if you give me a book that's written in some foreign language or some Asian language where the characters are different, I can say it's a beautiful book, but I can't tell you what's inside. I have to be educated for that. And the same is with traditional African art. You can either look at it and be attracted to it, or you can be repelled by it. But if somebody says, do you like it? No, I don't like it. Why? I don't know why. I just don't like it. That's not a good enough answer. You've got to learn that there is a language that is apparent, physically apparent, to the traditional arts. And that language, if you speak it, will tell you something about the people. And because it was designed to be used, it is going to look the same way if created in 1850 as in 1950, because the language does not change. It's the same as the flag of the United States. If we sent the flag out to be repaired and it came back with purple and green and orange on it, that's not the message. And we speak the language of the flag. The flag is not just a piece of fabric looking beautifully flapping in the breeze. It is history. But you've got to be taught that, because you won't get it just by looking at it. You have to be told what it stands for. And we, as old as I am, used to be told what that meant. And so it was more than a piece of fabric. It meant, it told you that you knew something about the history of this nation. So when you look at a work of traditional African art, if you have become further educated and involved, and I don't mean that you have to have a college degree at all, you just have to be able to speak that language. If you speak the language that is apparent on the surface of that art object, you will understand what it is. But if you don't speak it, you can still appreciate it, because art is so personal. You can either appreciate it just because it appeals to you, or you can turn away from it because it doesn't appeal to you. But if you want to go beyond the surface, you've got to speak the language.
So tell, as the director of the African Art Museum, just tell us about what your duties cover, what you do on a daily basis or weekly.
Thank you. We are a very small museum, and our budget, if it's not blasphemous to call it a budget, is even smaller, because we don't pay salaries. We have a core of dedicated, ultra-dedicated volunteers. And sometimes, you know, when you hear that, you think, well, people will open if they feel like it or close it. You know, I don't want to cut volunteers short, because they are the backbone of our society. But we are professional volunteers. When we say we open at 10, we open at 10. Now, because we have a small staff, and it's almost blasphemous to call us a staff, but because we have a small staff, if we are invited somewhere to go and to make money to pay our rent, we might have to close the museum for that day, but we put it on our telephone that we are closed on this day. And we also observe the late openings and the early closings of the Howard County Public School System, because we're talking about safety there. You know, but as the director, a director's job is to direct, and the director's job is to bring in resources, and it's not always money, but resources for the museum, so that the museum will live in perpetuity. This director also happens to vacuum, dust, sweep, and other duties as assigned as needed, mm-hmm. because we don't have a big staff. And so I will, sometimes I've been given the authority by the members of the Board of Trustees, and they are absolutely marvelous people. I've been given the okay to act when I need to as curator. If somebody comes to me because I know something about African art. Now, as a rule, the director doesn't have to know his subject matter, but he or she does have to know how to direct people. And mm-hmm. in a museum, you're going to have a director, you're going to have a curator, you're going to have a registrar, you're going to have an education department, you're going to have an exhibit designer and an exhibit installer. You must have maintenance and public relations. And the mm-hmm. educational thing comes under the, but sometimes you have a separate, if you're a big enough institution, you have an education department. I have to, and I do it with delight, have to act in all those capacities at one time or another. Not to say that we don't have a member of the board, Charles Bonham, who is the director for membership. He will do that. But I won't, if somebody comes in and asks about membership, I won't say, well, you have to call Charles. I will talk to them about membership, mm-hmm. because it's also the director's responsibility to bring in resources. And that's not always money, but money helps. But resources, people who are willing to be sponsors for our educational programs and our pleasurable programs. Mm-hmm. But our pleasurable programs are also educational programs. We don't do anything that doesn't reek of education, but we might dress it up. I mean, we combine jazz with an opening of a new exhibit or some new items in there. And because the people know this museum, we're 37 years old, because they know us, they know the history of the museum, they know the reputation of the museum, they're going to come and they support us. The community has been beautiful to us. I mean, that's why, with so narrowly focused, why we've been able to go for and be successful. True, mm-hmm. we're not rich at all, but why we have been here for 37 years. Also, the Howard County Public School System, we are partners with them. And we're partners with Howard Community College as well. Our reputation is stellar, you know. Mm-hmm. We are very careful about what we do and about what we say and how we do it. If we can't do something that reeks or reflects first class, and I don't mean it has to be expensive, because first class means energy. You mm-hmm. got to put time and energy and thought into it. Doesn't necessarily mean a lot of money. You can't do much without money. But your time and your energy and your efforts and your thoughts really determine, and taking care of the detail, they really determine how successful that event is going to be. And so the people who have come to us keep coming back, thank goodness, because mm-hmm. we have demonstrated that we know how to do a thing, not at the expense of anybody else. But if we tell you we've planned this event, people have come to expect certain things from us. Mm-hmm. And we do everything that we can, not to give them what they want, but to do all that we know should be done. When people take the time and the energy and the trouble to come out to you, they're not looking for you to be planning it on spot.
And so, you're speaking of events, so the next question I have for you is, we're starting a new year, but before we start, look ahead for the new year. Give us some of the look back at the events you had for the year 2016. I know when I was looking at your website, one of the things you were advertising was the Baltimore Washington Jazz Fest.
Yes, my husband was a jazz enthusiast, and when we were located in Columbia, and we were in Columbia for 31 years, and again, Mr. Rouse often said how happy he was that the first museum in Columbia was about Africa. We came up with ideas that would bring people to us, because we are a small institution, and the art alone, especially if you're talking about art that seems to be foreign to people, that alone would not bring them there. So we approached people that we knew, and they knew us, and we knew that if we did it right and we had no intentions of doing anything else, that they would tell other people about us. And one of the ideas that we came up with was to help to perpetuate, out with a small contribution of ours, jazz, which is America's music.
Mm-hmm,
you know, it has its roots in the traditional structure of Africa, but mixing with the brass instrument. And I'm not an ethnomusicologist, but we've had ethnomusicologists come to the museum. We've done it all, if you can think of it. But the Bowman Washington Jazz Fest was just that. We rented the whole building in which we were located. We had our exhibit on the top floor. And we put one jazz artist in that gallery. We had four other jazz artists sprinkled throughout the rest of that building. And when you came in the front door, you had an option to go to any one of those five performances that you cared to. Or you could visit any one of the three bars that we had. And we did have alcoholic as well as non-alcoholic beverages. Or you could go to the buffet, and we had that on all three levels.
Sounds good.
So it was called the House of Jazz, and it was perpetual. You come in at 7 o'clock, and we had people outside lining up to come in at 7 o'clock with tickets. We had made there was a ticketed event because we had to pay the artists. Mm-hmm. And we had some of the most marvelous artists. We had, for instance, Stanley Turrentine, who we never could have afforded. We couldn't afford him today. But it turned out that he came to one of our events, had purchased a ticket and came to one of our events. And his wife was a dear friend of a dear friend of ours. And he decided he would give us a break on his price. Now, it wasn't free, and we didn't expect that. But he came, and that was a big draw for us. People said, "You're having Stanley Turrentine?" And they said, "But you said you're poor." And we said, "Well, you know, he sees that we're trying to keep jazz alive. So you could come in, go to sit in one room, listen to that jazz performer. If you decide you want to go to another one, you could go to the other. Or you could decide to visit the bar, where, as I said, there were alcoholic but non-alcoholic beverages. Or you could go to the buffet. Or you could go to the chill-out room. And we had a martini bar and a pianist in the martini room.
Nice.
It was a fabulous, and it was something we started.
Sounds great, yeah.
And we took a chance on that. But we knew that when one artist was on break, the other four were still playing. That's why it was called the House of Jazz.
There was never ending. Yeah,
it was never ending from 7 to 11. And one time when we had another big name down from New York, although we used also local artists. It was not a talent show now. We did not take in people to see if they could play jazz because that would be disappointing to the people who were there, who had paid for the ticket. But the great performers that we had right here in this area, we also had, along with the big names. And all of the rooms were always filled. I mean, there were people one time they were trying to buy tickets from the people waiting to get in because we had reached our quota.
That's amazing.
I mean, it was just fabulous. But one time, it was 11 o'clock, and they had to stop playing because our contract ended at 11.
Okay.
And we're very careful about money, but we also are more careful about hospitality. The artists, the people had begun to leave because they knew 11 o'clock had ended, and it was on a high note, which is always the best time to leave a party when you're having the most fun. My grandmother always said that, and it's true. And as they were leaving, one of them began playing, just tinkling on the piano as the other people were leaving. And some of the jazz musicians who heard that, who had were on their way out the door, unpacked their things and came back in.
Wow.
And then some of the guests started coming back in. And we thought, oh, goodness, we've got to get out here. Otherwise, we're going to be charged. But we couldn't do anything else. The people started coming. They're not finished. And they came back in, and we just had to pay. We weren't going to say, no, we got to get out of here. I mean, it was so funny because I stood at the door seeing them coming back in, and I wanted to say, no, no, but I couldn't. Mm-hmm. So they came back in. They unpacked their bags. They started playing. They had an impromptu jazz session.
Nice.
And when the people did leave about an hour and a half later that we had to pay for, but it was worth it, they said,
sounds like it was worth it.
Oh, they said, you need to do this once a month, you know, which would kill you because the hardest part of that was scheduling the artists so that, you know, a person who uses his or her voice needs more time to rest the voice than a musician with an instrument, we found. And so you couldn't just say, well, we've already done one schedule, we'll just put that same you could not do that. You had to rewrite that schedule every time. And that schedule was very important. And we had people in the room telling people when they should stop playing. But did they listen to us? Often, no. But it went beautifully. So that is the Baltimore Washington Jazz Fest. That is the House of Jazz. Now, in between the House of Jazz, we do jazz expressions. We can't do jazz in the building where we're located in the evening now. Because when you do that, our reputation was that we had bars when we were here. The building in which we're located now, which is the Baltimore-Washington Conference of the United Methodist Church, the space that we rent 900 square feet from them, but when we do jazz, we also rent other parts of the building. But there is no alcohol allowed on those premises. And at night, since our history had been jazz with a cocktail, we don't do jazz in the evening. We do jazz like on a Sunday afternoon. And our flyer reads, in an alcohol-free environment. And the first time we did it, we said, I don't know, because people know that we've had bars and all that. I don't know if they'll come. But we made it clear to everybody we can't have alcohol here. We had sold 80 tickets, but we had 130 people come. And they said, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. We have good jazz. We have good food. We are treated well. We know it's going to be a good program, and we get to see the art.
Yeah, booze isn't everything.
It's not everything.
You talked a bit about what you had for 2016. So looking ahead for this year in 2017, just give us a look. I mean, I know this will air in February, so do you have anything coming up for African American History Month?
Or? We are opening. We are adding new pieces all the time, too. We just got from Ben Vonderhyde, and he's a Pennsylvania resident, the stone objects. Well, we got it last year, but we're keeping it over. The stone objects that the people in the area of Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, who are farmers, are turning the soil in preparation for farming, and they're finding these stone objects. And some of them have been documented to be over 200 years old.
Wow.
We were the first ever to exhibit them, and they will never be shown exactly the way we have them again, because once they go back to the donor, he's going to disperse them. So we are keeping them over. We also, from Ambassador Marks, we just got 20 ancient African maps that we are putting in the exhibit. And from Ambassador Kenneth Brown, we have objects which he has given us, so many pieces. He was ambassador to 7 African nations. And his objects that he has given to us have really made our show. We also have something from Al Engelman, who is a member of the Board of Trustees, whose home is like an art exhibit. I mean, plus he's so knowledgeable of all of the arts. So we have something from him and something from Don and Nathaniel Barnes. Nathaniel Barnes, they are Americo-Liberians from Liberia. And, you know, Maryland has a strong association with the country of Liberia. Mm-hmm. And so the people who went to Liberia in the 1820s, the descendants of those people are called Americo-Liberians. So we are so lucky. We are so fortunate. It is true we work hard, but hard work alone will not cut it. You must have people come to you and agree that you're doing something well. Mm-hmm. And that's why that's one of the reasons for our success. We're poor, but I've never heard that you have to be rich to be good. And we are small, and I've never heard, but I mean, I've heard a lot of things, but it doesn't make sense to me that you have to be big to be effective. We are small and we are effective. And we have this because of the school curriculum. I was told in 1983 by one of the school administrators here in the county that they were including a unit on Africa in the 3rd and the 6th grades because of what the museum had done.
Wow.
That alone is a milestone. And I've been in the mall with exhibits, and the little boy walked up, and one of the masks that we had that was given to us by Al Engelman is about 30 inches high and looks like it weighs more than it does. We had that on the tabletop. And the little boy walked up with his father and he said, oh, daddy, that's a mask. And because it's so big, the father was apologizing for the son. He said, he's just a little boy. No, that's not a mask, son. He said, but your son is correct. It is a mask. And the little boy didn't remember that it was me who came. He remembered the important thing. He remembered and he said, no, Daddy, a lady came to our school and told us that was a mask. And the father said, really? You know, so there we were educating another or being part of an educational experience for his parent. You know, but the little boy had taught him something. That came from Paul Retz's wife. She was a teacher, our teacher in Howard Community College, in Howard County. And I had gone to her school and had demonstrated the mask by putting it above my head and whatnot. And he remembered that and showed his father what he knew. And the father was trying to protect him and saying, you know, the boy is just a little boy and all that. But the little boy was right.
Let's talk about some of the ways people can, you know, either volunteer or contribute to the museum.
Oh, my goodness. Thank you for asking that. We always need sponsors. For one thing, we always need trustees who are interested in perpetuity of the museum. Mm-hmm. Trustees, not just to be on a committee, and all the trustees that we have are hardworking, you know. So we always need trustees who bring in resources, monetary and otherwise, and who govern, who help to make the decisions. But we always need sponsors who will pay for or provide the funds for, provide the resources for events that we do. And we're very careful about money. You know, when you don't have a lot of money and you do get money, I'm very careful about money. Money isn't everything, but when you get it, you don't decide, well, we've got the money. Even when we get the money, we're looking at how we can best use it and how far we can spread it. And every sponsor we've ever had knows that. So we need trustees, we need sponsors, just out and out donations. And you can get, and that is as far as IRS is concerned, that depends on you. Also, memberships. Memberships are crucial for organizations, for people who don't necessarily want to get involved to be a trustee. You know, we have a $1,000 membership that was started by one of the trustees a long time ago. In 2010, we started it. It's called the Century Circle, and you give $1,000 a year, and we won't bug you anymore about membership renewal or anything. You're a member for life. And yet, even some of those $1,000 members, and it's called Century Circle because we're trying to get 100 of them. We don't have 100. I think we have about 40 now. But when we get 100, we will design this plaque, and that's why it's called Century, because it's 100. Mm-hmm. But I started to tell you that even if you are a Century Circle member, some of those Century Circle members who've already paid the $1,000 still contribute to the museum. It's amazing.
And you know, it was interesting, when we were talking on the phone, we're trying to set up this interview, one interesting thing you told me is that you're a HCC alumnus. Mm-hmm. And so I was wondering now, if maybe tell us about your experiences at HCC and maybe going around the campus today, is anything different? I know one thing you'll probably say is the parking.
not only the parking, but I was here in the early 1970s, and there were two buildings that made up the community college. And we gave an exhibit in February of 1981, because we started in October of 1980. And Jane Weiner was the director of the art gallery at that time. And we arranged with her to do a 30-minute, a month-long exhibit for Black History Month in the then Smith Gallery, in the old building with the gate that sometimes would not lock and
that. Yeah.
And we did that, and we told them that we were at Howard Community College. And so there were people in Columbia, they said, there's a community college here? And we said, oh, yeah, they did not know that there was a community college here. Well, we gave the first full-blown exhibit of the traditional arts of Africa in 1981 in the old building. I started one of my early researches into Africa and into African art was by our Professor Judy. That's all I remember about her. She was an excellent professor, however. She was the art. I took a course called Art in Man's Culture. And there was no mention in the text that she recommended for us about Africa. And I said, that can't be, because I know that Western artists have copied the conventions of African art, incorporated that into work. I didn't know much more about Africa than that. But I said, so she decided she was going to have everybody write a paper in her class about the art that they chose to write about, mm-hmm. and that the paper would eventually go into the library. So she went around the room and she asked everybody, what will your subject be? And I said, African art. And she said, oh, I'm glad you know something. I'm glad you know about African art. She said, I don't know a thing about African art. I said, I don't know anything about African art either, but I know that Western artists have copied the conventions of African art. And that's when I began to investigate seriously the arts of Africa. Now, Mr. Baker, I am Taurus the Bull. Mm-hmm. And a true Taurus, and an only child, which exacerbates an already out of the ordinary situation. And I was the only grandchild in my house for 5 years. Hmm. I've been told by my mother, by my aunts and uncles, then later by my husband, but he didn't know me until I was 15. But my aunts and uncles and my mother, how difficult I was. Now, they didn't mean that I was nasty or anything, but you know what can happen when you're the only grandchild.
Oh, yeah, I'm an only child, too. So.
And isn't it marvelous? You know,
they spoil you a lot.
And then they blame you for it, see? Mm-hmm. And so I've told my mother and my grandmother, and my grandmother never said that, but my mother, I said, I didn't come here that way. You all made me this way. So I need to preface everything with saying I'm absolutely adorable now. I'm a very, very nice person. But that other me is lurking right back there, and at any minute it can be turned on. When I began studying African art, I did so with a great deal of skepticism because, again, I knew everything. Mm-hmm. You know, I knew everything. And when I began studying, I didn't know anything about the arts of Africa. I had also lived in Europe for 3.5 years. My husband was a military officer, and we'd lived in Europe and had toured Europe and everything for 3.5 years. And friends of mine, both black and white, and were going over to Africa. I didn't want to have a thing to do with the African continent because I already knew about Africa, and I have to put "new" in quotation marks. I didn't know a thing accurately about Africa, but you couldn't have told me that. So I was negative and everything. I mean, I didn't browbeat it, but I didn't want to have a thing to do with it. But when I began writing that paper, I approached it with a degree of skepticism. Now, I knew that the Western artists had copied Picasso, Modigliani, and Braque, had all used the conventions of African art and clay. And I then read that African art is carved from one piece. And I said, now, isn't this ridiculous? Because I saw that jaw moving. And then the next sentence read, unless it had a movable jaw. So I said, oh, you know, that makes a difference. Yeah. But it has said, it's all carved from one piece. But I was looking for something, just like a person writing his thesis. You come to it with something in mind, and you're only interested in how you can prove your thesis. The rest of it you throw aside. That's what I was doing at the beginning. And I used to complain to my husband, I'm so sick of this paper. And Clausus, sweets, why don't you just let it, you got enough material, let it go. I said, no, I'm opening one more door. And little by little, Mr. Baker, because I could see it and because nobody else told me how ridiculous you are for not thinking or knowing about Africa, I began to be sucked into it. And so today when people ask me, how did you get into this? I said, I would like to say that I woke up one morning and there was an image of a map, you know, a cloud looked like a map, and I heard a voice saying, Doris, Doris. Mm-hmm. I said, but that would not be true. I don't know how. So I believe, honestly, and I'm not bringing religion into it, that it had to have been divine providence because nobody else could have told me what to do because people just didn't you didn't tell me what to do. The only time I had to do that was when my husband first went into the military, and it was the old army. And my husband said, "Sweets, you're going to have to laugh at the colonel's jokes, even when they're
he's
not funny.
Yeah.
And I was 21, and nobody had ever said anything to me like that. It just didn't make sense, Mr. Baker.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I said, "Laugh at the jokes when they're not funny." I said, "Why would I do that?" He said, "Well, because that's what everybody does." And so upon going in, I found that's what you did. And before you knew it, before I knew it, I knew I had to at least smile. I couldn't say that is ridiculous, you know. So you had to do that for the good of your husband's career, because his career was how he was taking care of you and his family. Mm-hmm. And that is how that world worked. The colonel wanted to think he was funny, even if he happened not to be at all funny. So I then began to be sucked into Africa, and now I think I'm a great representative of spreading the truth about it to people who felt the same way that I felt. I don't browbeat anybody. I don't say this ridiculous question or anything, because I know if I do that, first of all, that's not my style. Second of all, when you do that, you back people further in a corner, and they will never be interested in African art. But if you can sort of grab, you know, little by little, get them interested by relating to them things that you see on the African continent to things that you see here, people might be more willing to come into the door. And that's all I need. Once I get you in there, I got you. Once I get you in there, but I got to get you in there. So I don't know, other than divine providence, how in the world I began to do this thing, which to me is second only in importance to my family. My family comes first, and this African Art Museum of Maryland comes right after my family.
Okay. Located in Fulton, Maryland, the African Art Museum has brought awareness to a wonderful amount of culture in the African continent. Be sure to follow them to check out their exhibits and numerous programs they have throughout the year. I have been talking today with the museum's director, Doris Ligon, to go into more detail about everything they do. Doris, I want to thank you again for coming on the show today.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
That was a great interview. For HoCo Journal, I'm Alex Baker. I'll be right back on Dragon Digital Radio.
Hello, Kubo. What have you got planned for today?
Come on, this way.
Adventure can be found anywhere, but the best place to start is in the forest.
It's the most powerful magic there is.
Head outside to discover incredible animals.
Wow.
And beautiful plants that come together to create an unforgettable adventure. So grab your loved ones and explore a world of possibilities. Visit discovertheforest.org to find the closest forest or park to you. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the U.S. Forest Service.
Take a look under your bed. Find stuff under there? What about jobs? No? Now try your basement. There's a pair of overalls that overall you're not so into anymore. A perfectly good laptop that hasn't sat in your lap in months. And even more stuff, but still no jobs? Well, you really have both. See, stuff is defined as household articles considered as a group. Sometimes this stuff is no longer needed. Wait, no longer needed? That can't be right. Because remember those jobs you were looking for? Those are really needed, and they're the stuff inside your stuff. Even inside that winter coat that moved with you to Phoenix. Our job is to unlock those jobs, and it starts when you donate your stuff to your local Goodwill. Here's how we do it. When you donate to Goodwill, we sell your stuff to provide job training for people right here in your community. So just by teaming up with Goodwill, you help create jobs. And isn't that worth parting with the leftover keytar from your 80s cover band? Goodwill. Donate stuff, create jobs. Find your nearest donation center at goodwill.org. A message from Goodwill and the Ad Council.
Hey everyone, let's all stop what we're doing and take a moment. You see? Every moment can be kind of special. But they can be loud moments, goofy moments, dorky moments, it doesn't matter. Because every time dads like us take a moment like that to spend with our kids, well, it's pretty momentous. So let's take a moment to make a moment. Call 877-4DAD-411 or visit fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
That's it for our show today. Thanks to Alex and all our guests this month, not only for taking the time to speak with us, but also for all they do to make our community a more savvy and diverse place. I also want to thank you for listening to our show and for staying connected with us through social media, our website, and our podcast page, dragondigitalradio.podbean.com. If you would like to share your story, contact me at moviedo@howardcc.edu. That's moviedo@howardcc.edu. Or you can connect with me via Facebook at our page, Dragon Digital Radio, or on my page at Cris Oviedo. This month of February and every month, spread love and happiness wherever you go. Until next month, I am Cris Oviedo.